From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. You send your kids off to college and hope for the best. But when it goes wrong, then what? Should parents be told if the grades are slipping or if there's a mental health crisis? Just because you're paying for the toothpaste or the tuition doesn't mean you'll be in the know. A couple of high-profile student suicide cases are shining a hot light on student privacy and a parent's right to know. This hour On Point, the mental health crisis on college campuses. You can join us on air or online. Is this your story? Parents, students, please share. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from New York City is Anna Mona Hartikolis. She's a high education reporter for The New York Times. You can link to her piece headlined, "His College Knew of His Despair, His Parents Didn't, Until It Was Too Late." That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Anna Mona, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you, Jane. Happy to be here.
Well, the story really gets to the heart of a dilemma about becoming your own person in college. Tell us specifically about the student at Hamilton College in upstate New York who committed suicide. You wrote about this.
Yes, I did. So this is Graham Burton. He was a sophomore at Hamilton, which is a beautiful little liberal arts college in upstate New York in a rural environment. He was a creative guy, played guitar, was interested in the classics, was a writer, poetry, playwright, short stories. And something happened in his sophomore year, and his grades went to pot. His advisor and his faculty, his teachers, started noticing he was flunking 3 out of 4 classes. And his advisor wrote a message to the academic dean saying, this kid is headed towards a crash and burn. I don't know what the policy or practice is here about contacting parents, but if I were the parents, I would want to know.
He said that in an email.
He said that in an email to the administration.
And what was their response?
It was not, yes, let's call the parents right away. It was a series of kind of routine attempts to contact the student, Graham. You know, can you come in for an appointment? Can you talk to my secretary? He and the academic dean did meet a few times. We don't know what transpired between them exactly. Meanwhile, some of his professors were getting more and more alarmed, in particular his Latin professor.
And the family says that the administration knew about all this. They knew that their son's grades were slipping, that he had some mental health problems, but they didn't let them know, right? They put themselves ahead of the parents as far as taking care of this boy.
Well, that was the issue that interested me. What is the right of parents to know? And so, you know, suicides happen on campus every day, it turns out, for a variety of reasons. It's a very difficult balancing act for the schools and for the families. And my goal was to explore how that works. And in this case, the family discovered only after his death, his mother discovered while reading his journals that he had been flunking his classes. He hadn't told his parents, even though they did talk about his classes. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure if you're a parent or if people listening out there are parents, I am, you can imagine that conversation. So how's it going? And what classes are you taking? And what are you learning in that class? And what are you, and you get, you know, you can talk about it. And you don't really know if they're getting, I mean, I don't know what you know, but in many instances, one doesn't know in great detail the kid's grades.
Right.
And the mother in Graham Burton's case realized at some point that she had never even seen a transcript.
This case is not unique by any means. Is it fair to say from your reporting that even when the suicide threat is explicit, that colleges have been historically reluctant to bring in parents?
Well, they have, and that's the Olivia Kahn case. Let me just add one thing about the transcript, by the way. The reason she didn't see the transcript was not necessarily because her kid didn't want her to see it, although he may not have wanted her to see it, we don't know, but because you don't see it without explicit consent from your child. You just don't see your kid's college transcript, and I'll leave it at that. So on the because of federal law, which we could discuss later. Mm-hmm, but anyway, mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. on is if the threat is explicit, yeah, sometimes it is, and the college administration will take it upon itself to maintain that confidentiality. Mm.
Anna Mona, let me bring another voice into the conversation. Joining me from DeLand, Florida, is Peter Lake, professor of law and director of the Center for Excellence in Higher Education Law and Policy at Stetson University College of Law. Peter, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Oh, hi, Jane. It's great to be here today.
So we just heard Anna Mona speak about this case at Hamilton College, this young man, Graham Burton, who committed suicide. His parents didn't know he was struggling. Talk to us about the federal laws that Anna Mona referred to that may prevent colleges from reaching out to parents when their children are in crisis.
Yeah, there's a longstanding federal law from the 1970s that essentially blocks access to a lot of information in college. FERPA was passed at a time, I think, when students had depression-era parents like I did and wanted a certain amount of independence from their families. Things have changed tremendously since FERPA came in many, many years ago. And I think what we're seeing is that federal privacy laws are really, really bumping up against the needs of the modern college and the modern college students and their families. Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure that anybody really wants FERPA anymore in the form that it's in.
So FERPA stands for Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, just for our information. I wanted you to talk about the MIT case and the recent ruling in Massachusetts related to this. Here is a clip. The family of Han Nguyen was an MIT graduate student who killed himself in 2009, sued the school for wrongful death. In oral arguments heard last year, the family's attorney, Jeffrey Beeler, said MIT employees should have taken steps to prevent the student from taking his own life.
If you say to the schools, you don't need to use reasonable care except during what would be a imminent suicide crisis, a kid standing on the side of the building saying, I'm going to jump off, you miss the opportunities to intercede earlier in the process, which is when you can save these students.
In the ruling, the court stated that though colleges and universities bear some responsibility in protecting their students from harm, universities are not responsible for monitoring and controlling all aspects of their students' lives. That's from the ruling. A key factor is apparently whether a school or its employees could reasonably anticipate harm coming to a student from this school failing to take steps to protect that student. Is that right, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, it's really dead on, and it's something that I've been arguing for decades now, that the right answer in these situations is a balance of rights and responsibilities, and we're neither bystanders to our students, nor are we controlling custodial agents, that we need to intervene when we have a reasonable chance to do so. And I think the ruling for Massachusetts really points out that it's important for us to actively intervene, but we won't always succeed. And not every time that we are not able to stop a suicide is a failure that's a matter of legal liability. Mm-hmm. I think the Massachusetts Supreme Court is encouraging us to actively engage with our students, but not engage in such a way that violates their rights to privacy or autonomy, or even interferes with the basic academic mission to build resiliency and independence.
So is it fair to say the ruling suggests that colleges are not bystanders to student safety, that they have to create opportunities to engage with these students in programs around this issue?
That's exactly the way I see it. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago, back in the 1990s, when colleges really deflected away from significant safety involvement with students. I mean, there are cases even in Massachusetts where people went to court and argued that students were basically owed no safety responsibilities at all, even in residential facilities. And we've come a long way from, you know, sort of the Kitty Genovese moment where we might be watching our students and not have any responsibility legally to intervene. We're not bystanders anymore. It's time to engage.
But it's not just FERPA, as you mentioned, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. It's HIPAA, too, right, which covers medical privacy laws. How does that play into this?
Yeah, there's a couple of dimensions to this. I mean, there's the federal law, which relates to student educational records. There are state medical privacy laws and also some digital privacy laws, although HIPAA usually isn't the primary medical law that we're concerned with. And those issues relate to the release of information, whether that release is required or permitted. This runs parallel, I think, to the Massachusetts case, which is really focused on what kind of active intervention strategies are necessary. And what we're seeing, and I think this segment really hits this head on, is that at some point in an engagement strategy, the question of when to involve the parents is on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, that's to the great benefit of an individual. Other times, it actually could be a source of challenge. And one thing I know we'll be discussing down the road is if we're talking about parental notification, we have to be careful not to put a student at risk. I mean, sometimes the family is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not advisable to alert family members or even friends.
I'm up against the break here, but in 15 seconds, are these college students effectively legally adults? I mean, the parents are paying for, in many cases, tuition or some sort of financial assistance. Are these kids adults?
You know, this is this bright line attitude that somehow at 18 or matriculation into college, you magically mature into adulthood has, I think, in some ways been a distractor.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know that the status as an adult is the single factor that really animates this.
We'll continue that after the break, Peter. Stick with me. We're discussing the mental health crisis on college campuses this hour and who has a right to know what is going on. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Parents, what's your expectation here? Do you even know the policy at your child's school? Should the right to privacy be waived when a student is in crisis? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you love to find and hear great new music, but you don't know where to start, let All Songs Considered be your guide. It's NPR's weekly music discussion and discovery podcast with tons of new songs and artists to fall in love with. Hear All Songs Considered in the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the moral and legal obligation that colleges have when students are in crisis. You can join the conversation. College students, would you want your parents to know if you're having a hard time, if you're in crisis? What expectations for privacy do you have once you leave home and become an adult? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour, Anna Mona Hartikolis, higher education reporter for The New York Times, and Peter Lake, director of the Center for Excellence in Higher Education Law and Policy at Stetson University College of Law. I want to play these clips. Last year, attorney Kevin Martin, who represented MIT in the case that we referred to earlier, argued before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court that colleges and universities are not legally bound to protect students from suicide.
No court has recognized a special relationship duty to protect somebody from their own self-inflicted harm. Society does not expect, for example, a landlord to protect a tenant from committing suicide in their own apartment building.
And here's University of Tennessee student Story Sims telling a local TV station WBIR Channel 10 that her pursuit of good grades led to her anxiety and panic attacks.
I've always cared a lot about my grades. You know, I used to be that kid, if it's below a 90, I failed. And so that was always really hard for me because I was such a perfectionist, so my anxiety just overcame me all the time, like I have to be perfect.
A lot of reaction online to this. One comment from our website, there may be a lot of mental health issues going on at colleges, but I still think that students have a right to privacy and that colleges should only communicate to families what a student wants. College students are 18. They are legal adults. Dale from Facebook says, it's a difficult question once the child becomes an adult. I work as a pharmacist and I have had many parents check in on their kids. We always explain that HIPAA does not allow us to divulge any information without the individual's permission. Many parents cannot accept that, but the law protects privacy. And Eric says college students are adults with the right to privacy like anyone else and are entitled to make their own life choices, even one as extreme as this. Even in the face of such tragedy, we cannot breach parents' confidentiality, students' confidentiality, or personal autonomy with regard to mental health. Anna Mona, this case is not unique, the one at Hamilton. We mentioned the case at MIT that just received this ruling. What are some other examples that you've seen in your reporting of this?
So in my story, I talk about Olivia Kong at the University of Pennsylvania. She's one of 14 suicides in the last 5 years. It's a high number by any standard. Mm-hmm. And she was a case where, contrary to the boy at Hamilton, she explicitly talked about wanting to commit suicide. She went to the counseling center and said, I'm having thoughts of killing myself. She wanted to withdraw from, she was taking 6 classes, very heavy load. She wanted to withdraw from 1 class, and she wrote in the withdrawal form, filed electronically, I have had thoughts of killing myself. She told the on-call psychiatrist, I'm going to go back to campus. She was at home at the time for the weekend. I'm going to go back to campus on Sunday and kill myself. And on Monday, she killed herself.
So Peter Lake, in a case like that, I'm not sure parents know they wouldn't be informed if their child was struggling with a severe mental health issue. I think most parents, especially if they're contributing in some way to this college experience, would expect the college would at least notify them. Is that right?
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot of parents, are really not aware of the big change in law that occurs as students move from K to 12 into higher education, and their involvement in their students' development is very hands-on in the K to 12 experience, and then something shifts, and I don't know that they get the note from the institution that basically informs them that things are going to be this different. I mean, the other dimension of this, which is very challenging, is that truly suicidal individuals often hide or mask their behavior, especially from the people closest to them. And so it can create kind of an ambush phenomenon, not just for the institution, but also for family members. And if I could, just going back to the clip that you played earlier, I really do want to challenge the idea that suicide is an entirely private event. The impact on a community is very dramatic, and so a suicidal moment is not entirely a private experience. It actually has dramatic implications for the wellness of others in the community, including the suicidal individual, not the least of which is first responders to the scene. Even professional first responders often have severe trauma when responding to the scene of a suicide. Mm-hmm.
Peter Lake, Director of the Center for Excellence in Higher Education Law and Policy at Stetson University College of Law. Peter, thank you very much for your expertise and your work on this issue. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Jane.
Let me bring in now from State College, Pennsylvania, Ben Locke. He's a psychologist and Senior Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at Penn State University and founding director of the Center for Collegiate Mental Health and an international practice research network of more than 380 counseling centers. Ben, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Great to be with you today.
Well, thank you. You're right in the middle of all this. What are you hearing in this conversation? Should university counseling centers tell parents when a student's in crisis or no?
Well, I think it's a very timely question. I think Peter really highlighted the complexities and nuances of this. I want to start just by saying that any suicide is a tragic loss, and my thoughts are always with the families coping with this, and that the staff in counseling centers around the country and student affairs services more broadly literally spend their days every day avoiding these kinds of outcomes and working tirelessly to do so. And there are a great many cases where staff in counseling centers do reach out to families, almost always with a student's permission, to bring them into the loop, and that the outcomes of those outreach efforts are incredibly variable, with some families immediately coming up to pick up their students and other families refusing to come pull their student from school, even when informed of statements and risk and behaviors that are very concerning. So I think in the best case scenarios, which is typical, professionals are working very closely with all of the staff at the university, faculty, advisors, and also the families to coordinate the appropriate response. And Peter's comment is on point as well, that some individuals do very effectively mask their behavior. They refuse services, and it can be very challenging to manage privacy in those situations.
Let me get a student voice in here. Rachel is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jean.
Hi.
Hi. So I am about to graduate on Sunday from Davidson College, and I have dealt with mental health issues, pretty serious ones, for about the last 3 years of college. And just my own experience, I think Peter mentioned this, that if my parents had been brought into the situation, it would have made things much worse. Mm. A lot of the problem was my relationship with my family and the pressure I was feeling from them and bringing them in at that point. They know everything now, but at that point, it would have been really hurtful and harmful. But what my counselor did do is connect me to a lot of student support within the college. So the academic deans, my advisor, my professors, other counselors. And she really helped me to make connections on the campus that helped me to heal. And I think that was more effective in my personal case than contacting my parents and saying, hey, Rachel's having problems and we need you to come help.
Gosh, I appreciate your insight, Rachel. Thank you very much for calling, and congratulations on your graduation.
Thank you.
Ben, Rachel brings up an important point. Sometimes the parents, the family, are a contributing factor. How do you take that into account?
Yeah, absolutely. And congratulations to Rachel, both on her graduation and her courage for coming forward with this. Yeah, frequently families are a contributor to the reasons that a student is seeking treatment. And professionals have to balance those factors with a family's concern. And sometimes a family's concern is really at the heart of the problem, that they are overbearing or intrusive or will actually make things worse. And so just as Peter mentioned before, it is this balancing point between notifying parents and protecting students' right to privacy. Mm-hmm. The mental health providers have to balance the students' expressed and actual needs with, families' interest. And, I just want to mention that folks are not really talking about the fact that college is actually protective. So, a recent AP article confirmed many decades of research prior to this that the rate of suicide among college students is at least half, if not even a third, that of the general population. Hmm. And it raises an interesting question of whether we are expected to treat college students differently or than the general population of similarly aged peers. And if so, why?
And yet,
is college protective, or are the students coming in from a different place? I mean, is there? I would wonder whether there's a cause effect going on there. Really,
certainly, cause effect is a perspective, but it is a fact that if you are in college, regardless of the exact etiology, you are far less likely to die by suicide. And we are not having the same conversations that we're having now in the general population. And it feels important to acknowledge that college students really are there are tragedies, and they do occur nationally. And yet college students also generally have access to some of the best mental health services available, sometimes faster than they would find anywhere.
Really? I'm reading about college counseling centers that have a 2-week appointment backlog. Students turned away after a few appointments because,
sure,
they exceed the maximum allotment. I mean, not to mention that so many of these counseling services are short term.
Sure. Well, and there's a huge difference, and it's important to understand that there is a difference between emergency urgent services versus ongoing long-term treatment. And short-term care is a routine kind of treatment that's available, six sessions or less. And urgent services, emergency services are always, almost always, that I'm aware of, available to students.
So let me ask Anamona about that. What's the state of mental health services on these college campuses, the facilities themselves and the professionals who treat them?
I think overall, college campuses are adding more mental health services because, as Ben knows well, because his center has written about this, the demand has been rising. Anxiety and depression have been rising among college students over the last few years. There may be some caveats to that, which you could discuss. But what the students have told me is exactly what your point was, Jane, which is, they operate 9 to 5 for the most part, and the kids want to go in at 9 o'clock, or they have to call at 1 in the morning because that's when they're panicked. And so there is something missing there.
So many callers here. Let me get Ashley from Milwaukee on the line. Hi, Ashley. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Please go ahead.
So I'm calling as a mental health therapist. I've worked in the University College Counseling Center before. I'm really glad this conversation is happening, and it brings up so many points, one being prevention. So I think the expectation that we ask college students to go through a major life transition while dealing with so much anxiety and then expect that they know how to speak about their emotions or ask for help or even know what their resources are, kind of a high expectation and something that maybe we could work on at the high school level.
Mm-hmm.
How many students are going for counseling or mental health check-ins at the high school level? Talking about anxiety, talking about processing emotion, working on some of these interrelationship skills that create problems later down the road when there's less family support.
So, Ashley, let me ask you, did you see students coming in with pre-existing conditions, coming to college with these problems or developing them on campus?
A mixture of both. I think predominantly the students that were more high risk were coming in with pre-existing conditions. Maybe they didn't have a name for it or hadn't sought help for it yet, but some pretty major depression, major anxiety, some personality disorders. So this isn't, you know, from my experience, it wasn't that students just came in, had one bad semester, and then started talking about suicide, which is not to say that that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But from my experience, I've seen that this is kind of longer term, and there are some things that can be done more preventatively up front.
I get it. Ashley, thank you very much for the call there in Milwaukee. Let's get Chris in here from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. First of all, 50 years old. I attended college when I was 18, and I just completed a semester of college. And the difference is huge. Back when I was a puppy, 18, you know, professor handed out an assignment. We did it. You know, we asked a few questions. This time, the professor would spend 10 minutes at the beginning of each class re-explaining the assignment. The kids didn't seem to understand how to do things on their own.
So you're talking about a parenting issue, helicopter parenting effect? You're blaming the parents here, not the kids. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. Yes, you are. And, you know, we have Utah having to pass a law about free-range kids. You know, it's okay to leave your kid out in the park by themselves.
Bigger issue here, Chris. Thank you. Let me turn to Ben. You've been doing this for a long time, Ben. How have you seen a change or an evolution over time, as Chris refers to?
Sure. Well, you know, I think one of the things that's important to note is that you know, again, crisis services 24/7 are typically available on most campuses. You know, I think the really important thing that we have to recognize, the key thing that has changed over the last 15 years is that we forget that the last 15 years, our nation has been in a massive national suicide prevention intervention with hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars spent K through 12 and in college to essentially identify and refer students at risk so that students in elementary and middle and high school already know how to identify and refer peers. And what we're seeing in counseling centers around the country is actually a dramatic success where the demand of students coming in is going up every year. Those students are more and more representative of students who might be at risk to themselves of of suicide. And really where the challenge is that all of these national interventions did not plan ahead for the increased demand in clinical services. And so what we're really coping with on the treatment side of the house is that we have to allot more and more resources to that those kind of emergent response scenarios. And there's less available for long-term treatment.
Anna Mona Hartikalis, I know you have to go. I want to get you back in here. Your takeaway after all your reporting on this in our last 15 seconds here.
My takeaway would be you send your kids to college. It's a black box. You put them in, you spend the money, they come out. Maybe they do something with their diploma. Maybe it takes them a while to figure it out. But there's something missing in the communication system there.
Anna Mona Hartikalis, reporter for the New York Times Higher Education. Anna Mona, thank you very much for your reporting and your time today.
Thank you.
Ben Locke, stick with us. We're discussing mental health on college campuses in this country. You can join us, listeners. Do you have an experience receiving mental health on campus? Does your child? I'm Jane Clayson. More after this break, including your calls. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're looking at college students in crisis this hour and how we define adulthood. You can join the conversation. How and when did the line of independence blur in your family when a child went off to college? Do you think you'd know if your child needed help? You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. At least 15 students and faculty members have died by suicide since February 2013 at the University of Pennsylvania. CBS Philly spoke with UPenn sophomore Joshua Tulanda about the mental health culture on that campus.
A phrase coined on the Ivy League campus as pen face.
Pen face is really pretty much where students really act like everything's okay when sometimes things aren't really okay.
Sophomore Joshua Tulanda says he has friends who experience it.
The school does a poor job of actually acting upon providing help. I've heard of many stories where people ask for appointments and they just can't get it because they push it back for so long.
Pen face. My guest today, Ben Locke, a psychologist and senior director of counseling and psychological services at Penn State University and founding director of the Center for Collegiate Mental Health and International Practice Research Network of more than 380 counseling centers. So many comments from our website. Dev writes, universities are not boarding schools with housemasters and guards. If students are ready to be independent, then they should not, if they're not ready to be independent, then they should not be there. Another comment focusing on the social aspects of college, universities could put a lot more effort into creating social structures, support groups, so that entering students don't get lost in the shuffle. Not all kids need this, but many do. Let's get Mary in here from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Mary. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm a parent, and I've had three children go through college. When our middle daughter went to college, we knew that we had to have FERPA waivers and HIPAA waivers in place because she suffered from depression. And even with that, the school would not share information with us.
Really?
And we had to be vigilant and go after them and make sure that they knew that we wanted to know what was going on with our daughter, and they still didn't want to honor those waivers. And because they didn't, it got to the point where she tried to commit suicide, and we weren't even notified. And we found out the day after by her, not even the school, even though all of those waivers were in place. So my recommendation to parents is have those waivers in place, and even if the school is pushing back, just make sure that you're vigilant with them so that, you know, you can be on top of the situation if you do have a child who is overwhelmed and suffering from depression.
Mary, thank you. What a great call. Ben Locke, it seems if consent forms and waivers are in place, you should be okay. If you're a parent who's concerned about a child, no?
Sure. They certainly help a lot in terms of communication. And I would just say that there is no such thing as a universal HIPAA waiver. Actually, HIPAA waivers by law are very, very, very specific to a provider within a time window for specific purposes. And sometimes students will will sign a waiver in the presence of their parents, and then as soon as the parent leaves, will say, actually, I don't want you to use that. So these things are very complicated and specific to the situation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let me bring another voice into the conversation now from Fremont, California. Vina Valuri is a junior at San Jose State University. She's also president of her school's Active Minds chapter, which is an organization that promotes student advocacy in mental health. Vina, great to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So why was it important to you to become involved in mental health advocacy at your school?
Well, I think one of the biggest reasons I joined Active Minds is because of the cultural stigma I've seen. I was born and raised here in California, but my parents are from India, and it's so difficult to see how much we have left in this journey of a stigma-free outlook on mental health. So I would kind of go to school and see how my peers are, but then go home to see that we're not exactly where we want to be. So what I saw at school was an inspiration on what I could possibly help bring home to my family and other minority communities. Mm. So this is kind of what made me really passionate about this mental health.
Yeah,
activity.
It's great. Here's a clip put out by this organization of which you speak, Active Minds. This is a young woman, Hannah, who lost her brother and father to suicide, talking about mental health and how the stigma stops students from seeking help.
Reaching out is not you giving up and being vulnerable. It's you being strong enough to admit, I'm having a tough time and I need help. Getting the help that I needed really changed my life, honestly. And I want other people to be able to see that it's okay to reach out for help and see that there is hope, whether it's the darkest of days. I feel that I've been there. But there is always going to be a brighter day.
Hmm. Vina, you hold a lot of mental health awareness activities, suicide awareness activities on campus, trying to bust that stigma. How does that change the conversation among students where you are?
You know, a lot of times during Active Minds events or tabling events, I always like being open. And I know that everyone's mental health journey is really different, but I'm relatively open about what I'm going through. And for instance, I go to counseling. One of the reasons is for anxiety. And that's something I'm so open about. And I notice that when I mention that to our members and we're just talking about it in this open, stigma-free, kind of positive platform, you get like a lot of faces from members like, oh, it's not just me. There's other people like that, too. And they start seeing that reaching out for help is not a bad thing at all, which is exactly what we're, you know, aiming for.
Mm. Our conversation this hour has focused on whether or not parents should be involved when their college student is struggling. What's your opinion on that, Vina? Should parents be notified? Should they be involved?
So I think, first of all, professors should be given some sort of training so they know what to do if a student reaches out to them and they know how to guide them to the proper resources. So coming to the parents, though, it should be judged on a case-by-case basis. If it comes to a point where a professor is worried about a student potentially harming themselves, I do think parents could be notified. Again, this may vary. I understand the argument that, you know, a lot of people think, oh, they're adults now, they have to manage. But in reality, most college students still need that support and lean on their parents. And sometimes it's hard to realize that because of the expectation that you're an adult now and you shouldn't reach out for help. Mm-hmm. But also, instead of parents just being notified, I think they should also be given some kind of guidelines on how to approach such a situation, because many lack the education on how to go about mental health.
They just don't know what to do. Yeah, I hear
exactly.
You, Aaron. Let me get a caller in here from Cedar Falls, Iowa. Aaron is on the line. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you.
Yes.
I have a quick observation and then a question.
Okay.
My observation is that earlier there was a discussion about, you know, how long the wait is for mental health services on a college campus. And I think that's making a really big assumption that there's easy access to high quality mental health services in the general population. And that's not always true. I know around here a 2-week wait for a kid into a counselor would be a great mm-hmm. Wait. So I think that's maybe a not fair assumption.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, what's the difference between a student going or an 18-year-old going into college versus an 18-year-old going into the workforce directly? I feel like we're seeing college as this, you know, place that ushers you into adulthood, and if there's a responsibility on the part of the people ushering you into adulthood, does that apply as well to employers of 18-year-olds?
Good question, Erin. Thank you. Ben Locke, jump back in here. Do colleges have more responsibility than, say, an employer at that age?
Well, I think that's exactly the question. You know, if we're going to apply this standard to colleges and universities, do we also need to apply it to landlords and employers? And I think Erin's point is, you know, echoes the one I was trying to make before, that actually sometimes a 2 to 3 week wait in the general population would be a wonderful outcome, whereas in college, folks view that as problematic. So these are very tricky.
Let's get Maggie in here from Dayton, Ohio. Hi, Maggie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
So I know there's been a lot of talk about, like, the wait list problems to seek regular counseling. And I know that's something I experienced at my undergrad institution. I sought services in January, and I was not able to actually be seen for continual counseling until the last 3 weeks of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
And my anxiety had gotten so bad, I was getting such bad panic attacks that I was getting, like, physically sick. I was throwing up by the time I was actually able to be seen. So my last semester of school was just insane. And I was not such a case that, like, emergent counseling was necessary. But by the time I started throwing up, like, 3 times a day from panic attacks, it was like, man, maybe that's the option, you know?
Did your parents jump in, Maggie? Did you talk to them about this and seek their assistance, their help?
No. And I'm a case, I was a commuter, so I live at home. Both of my parents are disabled, so I help care for them. And that was part of, like, the source of my anxiety, because I was under so much stress to help care for them, help, like, you know, do my schoolwork. I was working and had an unpaid internship. And I think if those counseling services, if I would have been able to get in sooner, I could have gotten so much further ahead of the problem.
Would have made a big difference. Maggie, thank you so much for the call. Good luck to you there in Dayton. Here's Erin in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Erin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for... And as someone who has been through this exact situation, I think it's suicide by overdose.
Oh, dear. Erin, please try us back. I know you have something important to say, and we've got a bad connection. Give us a call back, and we'll try to get you on. Ben Locke, aren't more college students coming to campus already on medication these days? And how has that changed the equation or the expectation for mental health counseling and counseling services?
Right. Well, what we know is that about 1 out of 2 students who come into college counseling centers around the country have already been in counseling. 1 out of 3 have already been on a psychiatric medication. And about 1 in 10 have already been hospitalized for a mental health concern. And so clearly, as students come into college with this kind of experience, there is a different set of experiences also, or rather expectations within the family for how those students will be treated. But it is worth pointing out that over the last 7 years, we have not seen a dramatic increase in these rates. They've actually been fairly flat over 7 years. So the perception that somehow students are sicker when they're coming to college is not actually supported by the data. Mm. What is clearly supported is that students coming into services are more and more likely to have seriously considered attempting suicide over their lifetime.
Veena Valluri, have you been open with your family about your struggles?
I've tried being relatively open, but there are a lot of barriers in the way, cultural barriers. And in general, I just find it hard to talk about mental health when you know, they're not as educated as I am about the topic. So it's difficult, especially when I'm going through a particularly tough time, but I do try to bring awareness. I might not tell them 100% what's going on, but I try to meet them at the 50%.
Let's get Kate back in here from Columbia, Missouri. Hi, Kate. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to, I'm a graduate instructor at the University of Missouri. And so I'm training to be a college professor, and I've taught several courses. And one thing that I and my colleagues have shared concerns over for several years is that the actual training of instructors when we become professors, there's almost no training to become an actual professor. It's all very research-laden, research-heavy. And what happens is when we get into the classroom, we have these students come with these issues, there's nothing that's been given to us as a foundation for how to approach these issues. Mm-hmm. And so I have many students coming to me in my office hours saying they have all these issues with mental health, and I went outside of my department and got the training through the counseling center to learn about suicide prevention and all those sorts of things because I cared so much about it. But it was not offered through my training. I had to do that on my own. And I have several friends who've taken new faculty positions at places, and they have students coming in. They're homeless. They have all these serious issues, and they have no idea how to respond. Mm-hmm. The new universities do not provide training when they come in right away unless there's an issue. And so there's a huge disconnect, I feel, between the training programs for professors mm-hmm. who are, in my feeling, very much on the front line with the yep. students who are coming in, talking to them about their issues, and then the students themselves.
For what they need, yeah. I hear it, Kate. Thank you so much. Ben Locke, you're on the forefront of this at Penn State, but I guess the question is, do colleges generally have a clear protocol for responding in these cases?
Well, I think those protocols are developing. Certainly, when students come to the attention of professionals whose job is to care for students in distress, absolutely the protocols are there. And but I think Kate is raising a really important point in that on some level, the stigma around discussing mental health concerns has dropped dramatically. And so students are very willing to bring these concerns to people they wouldn't have brought them to before, professors, friends, roommates. And those that same dynamic of dropping stigma is leading more and more students to come in seeking services. And what I have seen as a trend is that faculty and staff who might not have historically been trained in these skills are actively asking for training so mm-hmm. that they are better equipped to handle the students who are knocking on their door.
Vina, what would you say to students right now who may be struggling and to their families who don't know what to do?
I think I would tell them that it's really courageous to just to reach out for help, and reaching out for help, there's nothing wrong with that at all. And I would just encourage to talk to friends, talk to professors, and try to educate them more than opening. You don't have to open up your own mental health struggles if that's not something you're comfortable with, but educating professors and educating parents, it really will help us as a whole and help us hear more devastating news that we're hearing these days.
Well, we really appreciate the panel this hour and engaging and instructing us on this really important and sensitive conversation. Vina Valluri, president of Active Minds at San Jose State University. Thank you, Vina, for your great work, and we appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Ben Locke, Senior Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at Penn State University. Such great work you're doing there, Ben. Thank you very much for sharing it.
Thanks, Jane. Great to be with you today.
Thank you. Continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.